So we are in the middle of the first parak, after spending our first week on the introduction. The second week we got halfway through the story of the refusal of food. An appropriate theme, I suppose. We have food and for Daniel. We're told that Nebuchadnezzar, the king, tells his lead servant, or depending on what you want to call him, I suppose lead servant is as good a term as any, to collect from the exile of the Jews the best and finest. He wants to take the ones who are the brightest, the ones who are the most perfect in every way, and train them to become members of the Babylonian court. They're going to have to learn the language, they're going to have to learn the script, they're going to have to be able to stand in the court and learn all the manners of the court. That's what they're supposed to be, and they're given Babylonian names. We talked about that last time. Is he giving them Babylonian names as a way to demonstrate ownership? Is he giving them Babylonian names as a way to integrate them? Is it because their Jewish names all involve the name of Hashem? Hananya, Mishael, Azariah, Daniel. And now he's going to give them Babylonian names, emphasizing their belief in Baal and Nebo and so on. And then we said that the king decides that they have to also eat Babylonian food, not just any Babylonian food, but the food off of the king's table. And Daniel refuses. He says, we don't want the food. And we noted last time that maybe a kashrus issue is off of the king's table. But it may also be because he wants to demonstrate, you don't own me. I'm not part of this Babylonian system to the extent, yeah, I can't change what you're calling me, and I can't change the fact that you're making me stand in the king's court, but here's going to be my act of rebellion. I refuse the food from the king's table. So the approach the king's officer and say to him, we don't want the food from the king's table, and they're politely told, too bad, you're going to eat it anyway. If you're looking in Daniel, that's actually, I gave up my last one. Everyone here is on the email list, right? No one got it.
Yeah, you guys are both not on.
Yeah, okay, so afterwards, if you give me your email address, then I'll be able to send it to you in advance. So the king's officer, while he is friendly enough that he says, I'm not going to report you to the king and get you killed, nonetheless, there is no way that I'm going to give you anything other than the food from the king's table. I don't need to get myself into trouble by going along with your request. And that was in Pasuk Yud, that was sentence 10. He says, I can't do it because in the event that you don't look good to the king, in the event that the king says, these guys look malnourished, it's going to be my head on the line. As literally he says at the end of Pasuk Yud, my head is going to go to the king. That's going to be the result. So we're at Pasuk Yud Aleph, sentence 11. Daniel is stubborn. Vayomer Daniel el Hamelzar. Daniel says, and then it says, he says it to somebody. The word Hamelzar, what does that sound like to you?
Waiter.
The waiter, right? That's the way we usually think of it. Your translations render it as the waiter?
Steward.
Steward, same idea.
Guard?
Guard. Okay. So the reason I ask is because actually some suggest that this word was actually his name. In other words, his name was Hamelzar. The word Meltzar doesn't show up anywhere else in Tanakh. It's not really a Hebrew word at its base. You can tell by the fact that it's a four-letter root. I mean, there are no letters there that are there grammatically, except possibly the hey in the beginning. And it will be consistent with Babylonian names. And then the hey in front of it is not the. It's not hey, hey, it's not the definite object. Rather, it's Hameltzar is the guy's name. But because the only place it shows up in Tanakh is as the waiter in Daniel, that becomes the word for waiter.
Meltzar is a waiter.
His name was Hameltzar. Some suggest that. Okay. So Vayomer Daniel el Hameltzar. Daniel says to either the waiter or somebody named Hameltzar, either way.
With the hey.
With the hey as part of the name. Correct. Asher mina sar hasarisim al Daniel Hanani Mishal Azariah, who the head officer had appointed over Daniel and his three friends, He says to him, listen, I have a suggestion, right? He was rejected by the Sar HaSarisim. He was rejected by the guy in charge. So what does he do? He goes to the next one down. Here's, I'm going to try somebody else. He's going to push. Nas na es avodecha yemim asara. But he says to him, here's my thought. Give us a 10-day test. V'yitnu lanu min hazeroim. Give us from the seeds. V'nochla, we'll eat those. Umayim v'nishta, and give us water, and we're going to drink. V'yera ulufanecha mareinu, umareha yeladim ha'ochlim eis pas ba'kamelech. And then look, see how we look. See how all these people in the king's court who are eating the pati baga that we talked about last time, the food from the king's table, see how they look. And then based on what you see, that's how you should handle it. So, 10-day trial period.
What's nas again? Nas,
nas is to test.
Oh, yeah.
Like a nisayon.
Yeah.
And as a matter of fact, the word nas that we use for miracle is from the same source. It's something that's supposed to be visible, something for people to see. It's also a pull. That's another discussion. He says 10 days. So where in the world does he have the idea that 10 days is a good test? Where does that come from? So take a look on your sheet, please. Source number one, Abarbanel. And Ibn Ezra said this actually earlier than Abarbanel too. He says, "Ukvar zachru harofim." He says, doctors have already mentioned, "Shamazonos haroim yukar hezekam basanas haadam ad yamim asara." He says, you can tell the effects of poor nutrition by 10 days. That's what evidently the doctors know. It's impossible that they won't see the results by 10 days. So I went looking, you know, in medical papers, trying to find somebody who would say 10 days in malnutrition, you know, something. And what I found was source number two on your sheets from a journal called Clinical Nutrition, where it's a study that has nothing to do with this. The study is malnutrition in Dutch nursing homes. But when they have to do their statistical analysis, you have to have some kind of definition of what malnutrition is. So if you look at the way they define malnutrition, they offer three different criteria. The first one is body mass. Second one is unintentional weight loss, and they give a standard for that. And the third one is no nutritional intake for 3 days or reduced intake for more than 10 days combined with a BMI of and so on. So there you have it. Reduced intake for 10 days is a sign of malnutrition. So that tells you absolutely nothing other than the fact that somebody at some point thought 10 days was the standard. Okay. So Danielle, who didn't have access to the Dutch paper, But Daniel says, give it 10 days, and then you'll see. If we look like everybody else, then what do you lose? We can eat whatever we want. The king has to be none the wiser. That's Daniel's argument. And he listened. And he tests them. He says, all right, let's see. 10 days, let's see what happens. So, you know, why does he go along with this when you think about it? Granted that he might be able to get away with it, you're working for Nebuchadnezzar, and we haven't yet seen the full barbarity of Nebuchadnezzar. We're going to see it at the beginning of the second paragraph. This is the worst human being you ever want to cross. Why does he take the risk? So it could be, because what we saw earlier regarding the Sar HaSarisim, when we said that I think it was Pasuk Tet, we said that Hashem gave Daniel chesed and rachamim in his eyes, so maybe that's here too. However, take a look at number three. Abarbanel has a little bit more of a cynical take. He says, V'hamel tsar, which I translated as the waiter, go along with it. V'hamel tsar shamalet divrehem lasim hadavar b'nisayam. This fellow listens to them and says, all right, let's test. Why? In lamalos chayfetz Daniel, whether it's to satisfy Daniel, v'im ibnei to'eles hamel tsar atzmo, or for his own benefit, shaylo kach la'atzmo mipas bag hamelach, because he gets to take home the food from the king's table. Right? It's, you know, there's, he's got to put it somewhere. You know, they didn't compost in Babylon. So he takes it home, and he says, okay, now we get to eat off of the king's table too.
For sure compost in Babylon.
Yeah, it's probably true. Although I don't know if he did it in the hanging gardens of Nebuchadnezzar or not, but yes. So that's what happens. Pasuk Tedvav, sentence 15. Lo and behold, umiktsas yamim asara, at the end of 10 days, miktsas like cakes, nir'am mar'ehem tov uvri'e basar. They looked good. They looked healthy. Min kol hayiladim ha'ochlim peis pas bag hamelech. As a matter of fact, they looked healthier than everyone who's eating off of the king's table. They actually are in great shape.
Plug for vegetarianism.
You got it. Well, that's the question. Is this innate? Is this miraculous? Or is this actually, you know, a healthier lifestyle?
Were they really only eating seeds?
Yeah, well, my friend is legumes, which you could totally live off for 10 days, and is, like, very hearty.
And
there's a real difference between a poppy seed and a lentil.
Yeah, or beans.
Right, that's true. I mean, the only thing we have here is zero in, which is seeds.
Zero in? No, zero in. Zero in would be any gross. Like, zero is a growth. So it would be any vegetarian.
Hypothetically, yes. Hypothetically, it would be any plant. Yeah.
Right. Zero in could be right.
Well, not to be less likely, only because that's already a tree. Zero in really sounds like something growing from the ground, but we don't have anything definitive to tell us, except take a look at the following. Look at what I brought you on the sheets. In terms of whether this was a nace or not, Rsaja Gaon said it was a nace. He said this was a miracle, it shouldn't have happened, but God helps Daniel, Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah, which is consistent through the Sefer, certainly. Ibn Ezra, though, after quoting Rsaja Gaon, as well as Abarbanel, say absolutely not. Number four, Ibn Ezra. He says, V'yomar ha-Gaon, Zahya nace gadol. He says, that would be anachronistic, Rsaja Gaon said, this was a great miracle. Ve'ein tzarech. But he says, you don't need to say that. Ki hayu ochlim orez. They were eating rice. V'hu nechbad me'od. He says, that's a highly honored food that they're eating. V'arev men hachita. He says, it's sweeter, meaning better, than wheat. V'oset dam tahor. Generates pure blood. V'hu machal anshe hodu. That's what they eat, he says, in India. Ve'ein lahem chita. They don't have wheat.
And they don't have an obesity problem.
Yeah, there you go.
They will live to be like
160
or whatever
they are.
The whole
thing. He says they make food out of it. They cook it into food. He says, you know what you should do? There, he also cooked. He says when you boil it up in milk, then it expands. And as a rule, even a little bit of it will fill you up. Right? You may be hungry 2 hours later, but right then you're full. He says, rice and peas are these seeds that we're talking about, and he says they're very healthy. He also believes that if you like food, you'll do better with it nutritionally than if you don't like it. Somehow that'll be more beneficial to your system. It's not so surprising to hear Ibn Ezra say this. Rambam wrote a great deal on nutrition in his medical works. And his belief, really belief number one in the medical thought of the Rambam, is that digestion is key. More than anything else, the easier a food is to digest, the better it is for you from a health perspective. There's a lot to be said about the Rambam's medical advice, and specifically his dietary advice. We used to do a program in my shul in Pennsylvania. We did a program every year on the Rambam's medicine, and we had a dinner, and the menu was drawn from the Rambam's dietary advice. It was a lot of fun.
Everyone had to leave
a little bit full, a little bit on your plate. Definitely not vegetarian. Interestingly, the Rambam says that the worst food for a person to eat is matzah. It doesn't change the halakhic guidance, but he says the worst food for you is matzah, and he says the best food for you from an animal product perspective is chazer. Pork is the best, he says. He's not recommending that you eat it, but he's from a medical perspective. That's what he writes. Go figure. So yeah, I mean, his emphasis is largely on digestion. There's very little in terms of any sort of nutrition, you know, from vitamin, mineral. That's not in the realm of discussion for the Rambam. He blends together Greek medicine, Arab medicine, and a little bit of Eastern medicine in order to come up with what he.
A lot of what he says is not true, and that's not a problem.
Yeah, the Rambam is not writing this as the Rambam. He's writing this as a doctor, and this is the medical Yeah, but he veers sometimes in his medical writing into things that are beyond that. He criticizes Galen, the Greek doctor, for going beyond medicine into realms that are more like religion. And he says, stick to your medicine, that's what you know. Rama is very harsh when he says that, but Dhamma also veers sometimes into areas that go first into psychology and then off towards what he includes in the Mishnah Torah and Hilchos Deos, where he talks about a person's personality and mitzvahs and halachas that relate to that. But yeah, when he's talking medicine, I think the Rambam would be the first one to tell you, don't take my medical advice if it's been shown to be wrong. He has a blend of theoretical medicine and medicine that's based on empirical evidence, where if they observed something, they knew it to be valid. So, in any case, what I'm getting at is simply his preference for rice over wheat. It's a simpler food.
How does he know they eat rice?
How does he know that who eats rice? That they ate rice?
Why Ibn Ezra saying that?
That you mean that the Zeroim was rice? No clue.
Oh, he's just defining Zeroim as rice.
Yeah, correct. That's it. So Ibn Ezra's position is, of course they were healthier. It has nothing to do with a miracle. This was just smart from a dietary perspective. Abarbanel says that also, because Abarbanel does give you the vegetarian recommendation in number 5. He says, Lefisha ma'achal ha-basar v'hayayin. He says, meat and wine. Im hayoso rav ha-hazana v'ha-omets. He says, granted that they nourish, right, he knows there's protein, I guess, and they strengthen. Ein safek she'im shtifaso yuladu mimenu chalaim rabim. He says, if you immerse yourself in them, if you eat meat and wine all the time, the result is going to be that you get sick. Whereas seeds, this is much more simple, and therefore it's healthier. And he goes back to creation, the fact that we originally were supposed to be vegetarian until after the Mabul. And he says, V'lachein b'tchilas habriya, in the beginning of creation, shlo hayu b'nei adam ochlim ki imimei hatzmachim, when people only ate plants, v'shosim mayim, and we drank water, hayu chayayam aruchim yoser, that's why you find longer lives. He always wanted to know why it is that until the Mabul, everybody lives for centuries and centuries. Wow. Secret vegetarianism. M'kasher bono, when Noah came along, you can account for a certain change in years based on that. I don't know that you can count for centuries. At that point, they were allowed to eat meat. And then also, Noah, of course, has wine. That's when their lives became shorter to the point where they are today. Oh, and by the way, they also had Hashem helping them. Because they were righteous, because they asked well in this case, when they said, we don't want to eat the king's food, Hashem helped them. When you serve Hashem, he will bless your bread and your water. That's what Hashem did. And therefore they...
So it's not an ace or it's an ace?
So
that's like it
right.
Sounds like Hashem blessed their food.
That's
somewhat
right. It sounds like Ibn Ezra says not an ace. Abarbanel says not an ace, but they were helped. That's essentially his answer. It's both.
Daniel must have thought that he could live on the seeds and still be healthy because he wouldn't have asked for a miracle.
Why not? He will. He will later in the Sefer.
It's like when he's asking it, I feel like he assumes that naturally he could be healthy. Like that.
Well, that's one way.
Come and say, okay, Hashem just needs to help me with the seed.
Well, he is risking his life, but if he feels that this is what he's required to do, even at the cost of his life, it could be he's expecting to die. You know, it could be that he's, you know, he needs to convince this guy to give him a shot. So he says, listen, 10 days. And he doesn't know what's going to happen. It could be that he's just, you know, jumping off a cliff and saying, look, God, there are two options here. Either you let me smash on the bottom, or you save me, but I'm going to do what I think you want me to do. That's the other way you can look
at it. I don't think you ask Hashem for miracles so that you just so you won't eat food at the beginning.
Well, what we're going to see repeatedly, actually, in the stories in this Sefer, is that they do exactly that. They throw themselves off the cliff multiple times.
Very gutsy.
Yes.
So do you have to? Because what they're doing is something you have to do. It's not, right?
So that's a really good question, not only for this, but for future stories in the Sefer as well. So I'll give you an example. Nebuchadnezzar is going to make a great big statue. And he's going to declare That when music is played, everybody has to bow down. Daniel is out of town during that story, for reasons we'll have to discuss, but Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah are there, and they refuse to bow down.
That's different. That's Avodah Zarah. I compare that to not kosher.
The problem is it's not necessarily Avodah Zarah. As Tosfos writes, it seems fairly clear from the context that it's not Avodah Zarah, and the Gemara takes it as not Avodah Zarah as well. We'll see when we get to the story.
This is totally not a Yehiri Valiyavar, so why would they even...
So the question is...
He must think that he'll live on the seas.
Yeah, I agree with Reza. That's a premise that I've been taught before, that you don't rely on a miracle.
Right. So, two things. One is that the...
It's a high press to say that they didn't think... Well, it's like you can argue that. That's like, you know what I mean?
Like, what's the
date?
Like, what,
yeah.
Is it a miracle? Like
it
says,
they
well, it qualifies
not,
if they
say, but it's not, like, right? You know, I mean, I think for
name. Yeah. Well, he's speaking to the waiter. He's not speaking to.
But it's like.
And he says, not smart means test.
And the waiter did it for a reason. Maybe bring the food home. Like, so it's
like, but he just could be assumed that he knew he was on a very, like, higher spiritual level than the common men, and he felt that he would have merited to.
So I don't actually think that even if it is happening miraculously, I don't think that means that he's turning to God and saying, I demand a miracle. I don't think you have to jump to that. There are two points here that I think are important to realize. One is that this could be a Harag Bal Yavor. Meaning people are familiar with the principle that there are three mitzvos for which one is supposed to give up their life. Kilei Arayos, Shefichas Damim, Avodah Zarah, right? Idolatry, adultery, and murder. Those are the three that you can't give in on. However, there's another category, which is Sha'as Hashmad, which literally means a time of assimilation, a time when the person who's approaching you is asking you to do something because they want you to show, my religion doesn't mean anything to me anymore, I am now leaving Judaism. That's the Sha'as Hashmad case. And on that, the Gemara says, even if he tells you, non-Jews have a practice of wearing this color shoelaces, and Jews have been wearing that color shoelaces, I want you to change the color of your shoelaces. There is no mitzvah in the Torah about shoelace color. Yeah, chukos akum maybe to a certain extent. But generally it's understood that it isn't about a mitzvah, it's about him trying to make a statement. And if Daniel views this as eating off the king's table demonstrates, I accept Babylon, I am no longer a Jew, now I'm a member of the Babylonian court, then you could argue that it is Yeharag Bal Yavor.
Yeah, but no one even knows. So he's not making a statement.
Who doesn't know?
The king doesn't know.
The king certainly... Oh, who knows who's eating, that he's eating or not eating? In other words, they're, in fact, he's allowing them to continue to believe that he is.
Right. Right. Eating. So he's not making a statement. It's only for himself.
That's an interesting point. All right. I hear that. I mean, it's not just him, because it's him and Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah. The question would be, it's an interesting question. I suppose it depends on how I look at this fourth category. In other words, if you view the fourth category as a function of Kiddush Hashem, Chilul Hashem, then I agree with you. In other words, it's not... The level of Kiddush Hashem or Chilul Hashem is when you have 10 present. You have to have 10 who are aware of what's going on. That's what defines it. And under those parameters, I would agree. But I don't know that Sha'as Hashmad is necessarily about that. It may even be about your personal conduct. So I'm not so sure that distinction applies. But the other point that I want to make sure to note is that it could be he believes this is what he's supposed to do, and that only a miracle will save him, but he's not demanding a miracle. He's just saying, this is what I have to do. If God saves me, wonderful. Doesn't save me, better luck next time. But that's, it's entirely possible, assuming Daniel believed that Judaism believes in Gilgal, which is another machlokas. But the point within what we're seeing here is not necessarily that he's demanding a nes, it's simply a question of, was there a nes? There would be nisim through the Sefer. It would not be inconsistent with the Sefer for this to be miraculous. But Ibn Ezra, and to a certain extent, if I rebel, I think you don't have to read this story in this way. That's the way I would present it. Now, everyone is free to take this in either direction as long as you're true to what's here. So let's see where it goes. Let's see what happens now. Pasuk Yud Zayin. Actually, no, I'm sorry. Did we? We're up to Tezayin, sorry. Vayhi hamelsar noseyas pas bagam v'yein mishtehem v'noseyin lahem zera onim. Sure enough, this fellow takes away the food and the wine, right? He's, you know, bringing it home. And he gives them Zeronim. It goes back and forth between Zeroim and Zeronim. It's the same item. Vayiladim ha'ele arbatam, and these four youths, nasan lahem ha'elokim ma'adah v'haskel b'chol sefer b'chokma. Hashem gives them tremendous wisdom in every single area of learning. V'Daniel hevin b'chol chazon v'chalamos, but Daniel has one step above them, in that Daniel also understands visions and dreams, which, you know, figures very powerfully in the Sefer. At the end of the period of time when the king had said that they should be brought before him, remember it was a 3-year period, so the lead officer brings them to Nebuchadnezzar, king speaks to them, and in all of the youths who are in this training program for the king's court, nobody matches Daniel, Hananiah, Mishael, Azariah. And they become part of the king's court. Yeah.
They were training for 3 years, they didn't see him for 3 years.
So that part is unclear because of what's going to happen at the beginning of the second perek. Take a fast look at perek Bet Pasuk Aleph. It's going to begin with the story happening in the second year of the reign of Nebuchadnezzar.
Let's go backward.
So either they spent 3 years in training and now we're going back, you know, to this, or we have to reinterpret the year 2 chronology, which we're going to see. There is something to discuss in that regard.
They should have pretended not to be so smart.
Yeah.
And make believe.
Except that I'm going to come back to that actually, because it's an important point to ask about. But just to in terms of this. Daniel is not going to be there in the king's court at the beginning of the story. He's going to get summoned. But at some point, assuming year 2 means year 2 of the 3-year process, that means that he ends up being summoned before the king before the 3 years are over. But he wasn't supposed to be. He's not a member of the king's court. He's not living in the palace for the 3 years. Maybe Nebuchadnezzar from time to time saw him, and this was just they got the faher, you know, let's see how they did at the end of the 3 years, and, you know, their entrance exam for the king's court or their, you know, matriculation from their course, unclear. But in terms of the question of maybe they should have just pretended that they didn't know what they were talking about, and then they wouldn't, you know, end up in this position. So I think that's actually an important point because of a theme that we've already discussed of the association between Yosef, Esther, and Daniel, in the sense that all three of them could have laid low, and all three of them chose not to, and all three of them ended up being in a very good position as a result. I had this because I was learning with a Chavrusa the other day, and we were talking about the question of how Esther could have done what she did with Ahasuerus from a halachic perspective. So some argue that what she does is important to save all of Klal Yisrael. But in the beginning, she didn't know that. When she first goes to Ahasuerus, Haman hasn't even become second in command, right? She goes to Ahasuerus in Perek Bet. Haman is elevated in Perek Gimel. So,
and Mordechai gives her the whole speech.
That's Perek Dalet.
You didn't go to begin with?
Yeah.
She was shaking and screaming. I don't think it was a matter of, like, yay.
But women were bright.
Yeah.
Like, not.
She hid. She didn't put on makeup. She didn't.
Right. You could apply. Yeah.
And two things. First of all, unfortunately, Jews through the ages have found a way not to have to go and not to have to do. And it was suicide. This happened. The period of the Crusades especially is known for it. If she really believes that she can't go, right, she can say, you're going to have to kill me. And they'll kill her, and that'll be the end of the story. And Megillah Esther will be a very short book.
But wasn't this the whole thing?
Wouldn't it be easier when you're starving?
Right. But that's point number one. And then, but point number two is, you know, this is always an open question, but how, when she goes to Ahasuerus, and Ahasuerus is so impressed with her, that of all of the women who are brought before him, he chooses Esther. One wonders, what if she had sat there and not made conversation and just, you know, how much of the chen and chesed that Hashem gives her, you know, is gonna impress Ahasuerus? I think that one argument that can be made is that common to all three of these, Yosef, Esther, and Daniel, is that they understand that there's a value in being in the position that they're getting into.
Right. So there's a sort of health thing.
Quality Ruach HaKodesh, I suppose, is possible.
She didn't beautify herself. She didn't make, like, she didn't participate in all the different beautification processes, and still
doesn't.
But she does
that
actually. It says she did. Vaishana ves narosel et hobeis hanoshim, and he gave her the kamrukim and everything. Like the psukim say that he does. She doesn't perform, but once she's there, she gets. What Mordechai says is not clear. It simply says vatilakach is there. She was taken because she doesn't go willingly. And then, you know, Mordechai's next conversation with her is when he tells her, don't tell them you're Jewish. Right? You don't have any speech from Mordechai to Esther explicitly in the Megillah at all. Clearly there's some conversation. Mordechai's responsible for her. Presumably he's going to say something. But my point is only that your question is a good question. In other words, why doesn't he play dumb? The answer seems to be because we understand across the board that that's not in our best interest. It's actually important to be in the king's palace.
The three waiting period years definitely sounds like the 6 months and the like the preparation for the queen.
Right. Not to mention Yosef also has a preparation. No, he's in jail first. But I meant he galach by chalef sim lo sav. He has to shave. Lag Bomer's coming. He has to shave and he has to change his clothes. And there is an idea of getting prepared in some sense, although not as dramatic as Esther.
This is like having Jews in politics, so you can.
Yes.
That's different than Esther. I don't know.
Potentially. So let's see what happens, because there's so much more coming here. No one is as good as Daniel and his three friends. Pasuk Chaf, sentence 20. V'chol dvar chochmas bina asher bikesh mayem hamelech. Every manner of wisdom, every element of understanding the king asks of them, whatever it is, vayimtzaim eser yodos, al kol achartumim ha'ashafim asher b'chol malchus. So he finds them to be 10 times better than the best of the palace. Ashafim and Chartumim, Rashi says the Ashafim are necromancers, people who speak to the dead, and Chartumim are astrologers, which is a term we also find in Mitzrayim. Ibn Ezra says don't get hung up on being 10 times better. He says 10 is a nice round number. It's, you know, don't get caught up in 10. Although it is interesting because you have a 10-day period and here. Okay. Vayhi Daniel ad shnas achas lekoresh hamelech, and Daniel is there until the first year of King Cyrus. Now this goes back to something we discussed our first week, which is when does Daniel die? Does Daniel go back to the second base Hamikdash? And we saw sources that gave us multiple options. One, maybe he went for the second base Hamikdash. There's no reference to it, except we have that one medrash that notes that Daniel is lumped together with, if you read the Pasuk in Yechezkel, it's Daniel and not Daniel, so then Daniel is lumped in with Noach and Iyov, who have a period before destruction, and then rebirth. So that Medrash presents Daniel as seeing the beginning of the second base Hamikdash, but on the other end, he's not mentioned anywhere. And here we're told that Daniel was there until the first year of King Cyrus the Persian, who ultimately allows the Jews to go back for the second base Hamikdash. It is a long time. When we gave Ibn Ezra's evaluation of their age, he'd be somewhere around a century old. At that time.
Why are we learning this?
Yeah,
right.
Yeah. It's the vegetarian diet.
Why is this pasuk? And where's the other three of them? We're just learning, all of a sudden, they're just telling us how long Daniel hung out here?
Correct. We don't know anything about the fate of Hanani, Mishael, and Azariah at all. They're going to disappear after a particular story that we're going to see, and the Gemara is going to have to ask why do they disappear. So when we, you know, get to that, we have to see what happened there. But in terms of this pasuk and what it's doing here, what it's really doing is using the opening parak as an introduction to Daniel. This is who he is. So we give you sort of, if not birthday and dying day, we give you beginning of career, end of career, and now we're going to tell you about what happened in between. You know, the dash on the headstone. We're now going to tell you all about, you know, what happened in the middle. But there's a lot of debate as to what exactly happens at his end. I brought you a few sources on the sheet. Source number 6 is Rashi's understanding of what happened to him. The Hebrew's on one side, the English is at the top of the next side. L'divrei ha-omer hatach zed Daniel. According to the view which we've mentioned, the hatach in Megillas Esther is Daniel. And the Gemara then asks, which Rashi quotes, V'lama nikrashmo hatach shechatchuhu migdulasa. Why is he called hatach in the Megillah? Because he was cut down from his position of power. So we don't call him Daniel anymore. Daniel now has a third name, hatach, signifying the guy who was reduced. So Tzvichan Anulomar Shezil Koresh Harishon Shalifnei Achashverosh. He says, in that case, it must mean the first Cyrus, before Achashverosh, because this is a nightmare in its own right. And if we get that far in Daniel, at some point we'll have to deal with this more directly. But there are multiple Dariuses and multiple Cyruses. And the Persian records of who was king when don't match our records in terms of Daniel and the Medrash and Seder Olam of who was king when. There's a gap of about 160 years between our chronology and their chronology, which gives everybody big headaches. So I'm not going to go into the chronology now, but that's what Rashi's referring to when he's now going to talk about which King Cyrus we mean. He says, if you're saying that Daniel was reduced from authority, this would be the Cyrus before Ahasuerus. But if you take the view that he was called Hatach because of his great authority, it means that all of the matters of the kingdom were decided by him. Then Omar Koresh Zehu Daryavesh Hasheni Achar Achashverosh. Then I will say that this is the second Darius after Achashverosh. You know what? I'm actually realizing it's just going to confuse things more. Let me not confuse things more. There's enough to see. But what Rashi is trying to tell you is that Daniel has... Right, so Rashi is going to believe they're the same. Yes. It's the same person, two different names. Cyrus and Darius are the same, yeah. They're actually the same person.
Where does he get that from?
So when we get to the discussion of who lived when, and we can go through it, but that's essentially what he's arguing, is that there are two different names used for the same king. There's also a Darius the Mede, separate from Darius the Persian, who is Cyrus the Persian. And then there's more than one king named Achashverosh as well. And yeah, it's really nice. You kind of wish that they had all just been named Paro, and that would have been that. There's Paro 1, Paro 2, Paro... It would have been so simple.
The Persian version of Paro. Koresh or whatever. I'm saying if they all have the same name,
where it's a family.
It's like saying like a pharaoh.
Right. It doesn't quite work that way. The truth is the Greeks render Koresh as Xerxes. And then you have Ahasuerus as Artaxerxes. Like there was some kind of a family name thing going. But it's a little bit of a mess. The reason why Rashi does this is because Rashi argues that Daniel either has power in the time of Purim or he doesn't have power in the time of Purim, and that's what this is all about in his attempt. I'll just show you Ralbag in Abarbanel. Actually, I didn't bring Ralbag on the sheet. No, I did. He cited in Abarbanel. Source number 7. The number 7 is actually Ralbag who Abarbanel is quoting. And this is his version of what happens to Daniel at the end of his life. V'nitzal misham b'chemlas Hashem alav. Daniel was saved from there by divine mercy, meaning this is after he's thrown into the lion's den. V'loratza od lamo b'heichal hamelech. And he says, you know what? I've maybe risked my life too many times and happened to get saved. I think enough of that already. I don't really want to stay in the palace anymore. V'shal reshus mi daryavesh l'aleches l'sheves b'shushan. And he says, can you just let me go live in Shushan in peace. V'lamos shama, and to die there, ba'amroi lav, shayu kvar zakei, and he says to him, I'm already old, v'yu chalat zeis v'lavo, v'mishpate ha-malucha, I can't handle all the king's affairs anymore, v'gam shes ganav, v'yu mekanim bo, not to mention all of your officers hate me, I really had enough. And so he retires. And that's what happens in the first year of Koresh, according to Ralbag, granted that it'll be named Darius, as you see there in Abarbanel. And Abarbanel himself... That's Abarbanel himself. Ralbag, who I did not bring on the sheet, but I thought that I had, says that he either died or made aliyah. That's Ralbag's approach. I thought I had brought it on the sheet, but apparently not. Okay. So
and that's commentary on this pasuk that he was there until Koresh was.
Yes.
Until the first year.
Yeah. So the question fundamentally that you have to ask when you've read this story now is, what's the point of the story? What is this? Why is this here? It doesn't affect the lives of Klal Yisrael in general. In other words, Daniel doesn't, because he became vegetarian in this story, doesn't produce a line of vegetarian Jews. So what is this trying to teach us?
It's necessary background for what happens next. We don't know yet what happens.
Right. So I don't. You can look at it as background on what happens next, but what kind of background is it giving us?
Show me this.
The way we're supposed to behave.
The way we're supposed to behave, well, then it's not background on what's coming next. Then it's a different thing. Then it's a moral lesson.
He has guts, and he takes challenges. And
right. So,
like we said, he appreciates the value of being a part of the kingdom.
Mm-hmm.
And that's a lesson. Always, you know, like why choose the politics, or if you really want to take it, I don't know, maybe it's something like
that. Right. No, I think that there are really two ways you can look at this, and both valid. One is that it's there in order to teach us what we do in situations like this. The Kiddush Hashem lesson, the involvement in the king's court lesson, all of these are important things that we can draw from stories like this. And, you know, as I began when we started talking about Daniel in general, you know, the Jew of today who has some kind of influence, you know, in a Western government, you know, has to look at this and say, this is a guide for me. And by the way, I didn't mention it then, but it occurs to me now to note, that's not new with Daniel. Bereishis Rabba tells us that Rabbi Yehuda HaNasi, who was both the scholarly leader and political leader of the Jews in the Roman Empire in the beginning of the 3rd century, it says every time he had to go to Rome to negotiate with the leadership, he learned the beginning of Parshas Vayishlach first. Because that's about Yaakov coming back into Israel and meeting Esav. So he said, I need that to sort of ground me in what I should be doing, and it mentions that there was one time when he didn't do it, and then he regretted it. So the idea of this being a lesson for us, I think, is very important. The Gemara says in Megillah that there were thousands upon thousands of Nevi'im, whether Daniel is one of them or not, we discussed. But it says the messages that are recorded in Tanakh are the ones that have applications for us. It's not simply, this is your history and you should know it, but it's, here's guidance. So that's number one. Number two, though, I think it is introduction to what's coming in terms of telling us who Daniel is. Yeah, are you familiar with envelope structure in Tanakh? The idea of envelope structure is that you take a particular set of psukim, and you notice that sometimes, if you look at the beginning of it and the end of it, they're the same theme. Sorry? Well, I guess it is like Atbash in a sense, yeah. The beginning and end will be similar, and then working your way inward, you'll see the next part and the penultimate part will be similar and so on until you get to the middle. And the idea is that it's like an envelope in the sense that whatever's in the middle is what it wanted you to focus on, like the letter inside the envelope. So here, our parak began in, well, it was in Pasuk Gimel in sentence 3 with the king's instructions. Right? The king speaking to Ashpenaz was how we started the parak, starting with Pasuk Gimel and moving forward from there. And it ends in, you know, Pasuk Yudches and forward with the king's instructions where he says, bring them forward and have them tested and so forth. Then, the beginning of the parak, after the king's instructions, it speaks of how wonderful and magnificent they were. And in Pasuk Yud Zayin, right before the king's instructions, it also speaks about how wonderful they were. Pasuk Hey, dietary arrangements, and it concludes with dietary arrangements in Ted Zion. And then the middle part is the test that is proposed and executed. That's really what this is all about, is for us to see what happens with the test that Daniel proposes, how he is willing to put himself on the line in order to do what he believes is right. So that's the envelope structure, which various commentators note. The other point that I wanted to show you is number 8 on your sheet, which is Abarbanel summing it up when he says, Shloshes Hashlemuyos Shehayu v'Daniel, the 3 perfections that Daniel had, Poel v'Kosev HaSefer Hazeh, that's what's recorded here in this book. Shehem Mipas Yichuso Malas Mishpachto. First of all, his lineage and great family. We talked about that last week, and Abarbanel's special point about Daniel being from David HaMelech. Umipas Kedusha So V'Taharaso B'Atzmo, his personal sanctity and purity. I'm not eating the king's food. Umipas Chochma So V'Yidiaso HaEl Yonah Asher Chanano Hashem Yisbarach, and his wisdom and higher knowledge that Hashem grants him, such that he excels over and above the other candidates for the king's court. Clear? Okay, now, I don't know what time we started. I don't know how much time we have. So let me just take a fast look. We got 5 minutes. Let me just give you a very brief start on the second perek, because this is where the action starts. And we're going to have to ask ourselves the question of what the goal is in this story. We're just going to do the opening psukim. I'm not going to discuss a lot at all, just and I want you to see where we're going with this. U'mishnas shtayim l'malchus Nebuchadnezzar, year 2 of Nebuchadnezzar, chalam Nebuchadnezzar chalamos, Nebuchadnezzar had dreams. Vatit pa'em rucho, a very important phrase we'll have to come back to. His spirit, his breath, is interrupted. He suddenly has something happen. He can't sleep. Shnasoni hiyasa alav. His sleep either was on him or was broken. We'll see how you can translate that. Vayomer hamelech likrol achartumim v'la ashafim v'la machashfim v'la kazdim. He calls all his counselors of different kinds, the people who speak to the dead, the astrologers, the sorcerers, the Chaldeans, la'agid la'melech halom osav, to tell him his dream. He wants them to tell him what he dreamed. Not what it means. What did I dream? Vayavou v'yamdu l'vnei hamelech, and they all stand in front of the king. Vayomer lehem hamelech, the king says to them, chalom chalamti, I dreamed a dream. He breaks into song. Vatipa'em ruchi, my spirit, my breath broke. I was interrupted. Ladas sachalom, to know the dream. So by Deborah Kastim Lamelech Aramit, the Kazim, the Chaldeans, speak to him in Aramaic. We'll have to see why. And they say to him, Malka la'almen chayi, king, you should live forever. Emar chelma la'avdach ufishra nechavei, tell us what you dreamed, and we'll tell you what it means. Ane Malka va'amar le'kazdai. So the king says to the Chaldeans, Milsa mini azda, the word has gone forth from before me. Hein lasaho de unani chelma ufishrei, if you don't tell me the dream and what it means, hadamin tis avdun, you will be chopped up into small pieces. Ubatechon nevale yit samun, and your houses will be laid waste. That is Nebuchadnezzar. I keep telling you how like you don't want to cross this guy. That's who you're talking about. This is the barbarian who destroyed the Beis HaMikdash, who leveled countries, who killed thousands and thousands of people, and took it as a point of pride that he had done so. He's a brutal, brutal human being. And he demands what, on the face of it, is entirely impossible.
Does he not remember, or he's testing them?
That's part we have to discuss. Yeah.
Can they just make a...
Well, that's
the question.
Yeah, that's the very part. Well, when you say it, it's true, it's going to come back.
Well, that's what he says then.
Right, so we're going to have to see what happened, what it was that he was demanding, and so on. But I wanted you to at least get this sense of who we're talking about in this story and the stakes for Daniel. So we'll pick up, God willing, next week.